This is Geology Bites with Oliver Strumpel. Radioactive waste is the byproduct of activities that use natural or man-made radioactive materials. The main sources of radioactive waste are nuclear power stations and military activities. But while many of the radioactive isotopes present in radioactive waste have relatively short half-lives, measured in decades, some isotopes have much longer half-lives, measured in thousands, tens of thousands, or even hundreds of thousands of years. So, to dispose of such waste, we need to be thinking of timescales that approach geological timescales, which are orders of magnitude greater than any timescales associated with human civilizations. This has led us to create deep geological storage sites. What sort of geological context do such storage sites require? And what kind of hazards do we need to guard against on such timescales? Claire Corkill is leading the UK's research efforts to understand and improve the safety of planned geological waste facilities. Her research focuses on how radioactive isotopes interact with minerals and on how radioactive waste can dissolve in groundwater. She is Professor of Mineralogy and Radioactive Waste Management in the School of Earth Sciences at the University of Bristol. Claire Corkill, welcome to Geology Bites.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you bring us up to speed on the nuclear processes that produce radioactive waste?
So let's start with what happens inside a nuclear reactor. We start with uranium dioxide fuel. And the uranium, when uranium-235, a specific isotope of uranium, is bombarded by a neutron, that causes the uranium atom to split. And in doing so, it creates a huge amount of energy. And that energy is then used to heat water, turn it into steam, to turn turbines to create electricity. But the splitting process of the atoms also creates smaller atoms. And these smaller atoms are themselves unstable, and their instability results in radiation. So these are fission products that are developed inside the nuclear fuel, and they can have radioactivity of some seconds all the way through to millions of years.
So are those fission products then the main kind of radioactive waste that we are concerned with here?
Yeah, exactly. So when we've finished with the fuel inside a nuclear reactor, there are a number of different things that we can do with that fuel. So the fuel can either be removed from the reactor. It's cooled for a while because of the radiogenic heat means it's actually quite hot to the touch. So it has to be cooled for a while in a wet pond or maybe in dry cask storage. That fuel can then either be disposed of directly. We call this an open fuel cycle. Or it could be reprocessed, and that's because that fuel contains useful uranium and plutonium that could be turned into new nuclear fuel. And so the reprocessing is the operation by which you dissolve down that nuclear fuel material through a liquid separation, chemical separation process. You extract the uranium and plutonium, and then everything else that's left, that is the fission product, essentially. And those fission products, what we do is to dry them out. It's difficult to think about what this looks like. The dried out fission products ends up looking remarkably like instant coffee granules. This is not the kind of stuff you'd want to put into your hot water to drink, but they look just like coffee granules. And these coffee granules of fission products, they get mixed with a borosilicate glass, which is very similar to the kind of dish that you would put into the oven to make your dinner, and melted together and turned into a stable material. This is what we call high-level waste. So the spent fuel together with the glass we term high-level waste. There are other items that are created through this process that are contaminated with radioactivity. So, for example, the fuel pins, which are small pipes in which the nuclear fuel sits, these get split off from the fuel in the reprocessing operation, and they're contaminated with the fuel. So we call this intermediate level waste. It has a smaller amount of radioactivity than the high level waste, but is still quite radioactive. So there are lots of different types of waste that are generated through this process.
So some of this waste has fairly long half-lives. So do we try and extract the things that are likely to be problematic on the long term when we think about long-term storage, or do we just take the whole lot and treat it all together?
We essentially take the whole lot and treat it together. So there are shorter half-life isotopes like strontium-90, cesium-137, which have half-lives around the order of 30 years. What ideally we'd like to do is leave these isotopes for up to 10 half-lives before they're considered to be safe. So the shorter ones, like cesium and strontium, we only need to leave these a few hundred years, which means that we could store that waste probably in above-ground storage units for 300 years. That seems like a reasonable thing to do and let the radioactivity decay. However, there are much longer lived isotopes, and we're talking about things here like technetium-99, which is only made in a nuclear reactor. It has a half-life of 200,000 years, and it's extraordinarily mobile in the subsurface. So we really have to think about these isotopes that are going to take much, much longer to decay when we think about how we're going to store them safely over the timescales that are required.
Okay, so that gets us to the geological storage. So you have mixed all this stuff together with this borosilicate glass. Do we just take all that, find a deep geological storage, put it in there, lock the door, and forget about it? How does that work?
Well, really, we have to try and find the best place to have a geological disposal facility. So what we're looking for is a location where we can safely isolate these wastes from future populations. And the timescales that we're looking at are really civilizations. So we really need to find a place that's going to be stable and secure, I guess, over these really long timescales. And the timescale that most organisations who are trying to dispose of this waste are looking for is 1 million years. So there's really no better place to put this waste than in a stable rock formation that has been stable for probably billions of years, if not hundreds or tens of millions of years. So when we think about the disposal of the waste, I don't want people to jump their minds straight to the kind of the Homer Simpson analogy where you've got glowing green goo that gets poured down a hole. That is not what this is at all. This is a highly engineered facility somewhere deep below the ground. We're talking around 200 metres to 1,000 metres below the earth. You can imagine a series of large caverns and tunnels. And in these tunnels, we'll be placing containers of waste in a series of layers of containment that will ultimately prevent groundwater from reaching the waste. That will ultimately start to dissolve the radioactive things from inside the waste and transport them outside. That will inevitably happen over the long timescales we're talking about. So we use a series of layers of containment to try and prevent that from happening. So at that point, once we've disposed of the waste and we've backfilled the tunnels, then yes, we're going to lock the door. But there's a lot of engineering and thought that has to go into all aspects of that disposal facility before we can even think about building one.
Let's go back to the selection of the site. Now, you mentioned geological stability and billions of years. So are we really looking for these ancient cratons that have essentially been left alone since the Neoproterozoic, which are extraordinarily stable? Are we really trying to find something that's geologically stable on that kind of timescale?
Well, I suppose in a way, those kinds of formations would be ideal, but it's not necessary. What we're really looking for is any body of rock of the right volume required to dispose of the inventory of a particular country. And it has to have certain properties. The most important point is that it has a very low permeability. So I mentioned water interacting with the waste. If we can reduce the likelihood of water coming into contact with the waste materials, then we reduce the likelihood of it dissolving the waste and transporting those radioactive isotopes away into the geosphere and the subsurface. So number one key criteria is to find a low permeability rock. Now, lots of rocks are very non-permeable. So clays are very non-permeable. If we have a non-fractured granite, for example, that would be very low permeability. It could really be in any kind of rock. So we're also looking for somewhere that's very tectonically stable, somewhere where the rocks are not going to change significantly over a period of time of that 1 million years. We're not going to have intrusions of granite or dikes or whatever coming through the geological disposal facility. We're also interested in it not being close to any resources. So the idea behind this is that a future population might find, for example, a coal deposit if fossil fuels are not completely extracted in the future, as one example, or maybe it's a metalliferous ore deposit. We don't want future populations to go, oh, let's dig there, and then accidentally stumble upon some really dangerous, hazardous radioactive waste materials. So there are a number of different criteria that would make us think that a site is potentially suitable.
So when we find an ideal site like this that has the right geological properties. Do we use that for the waste from many different countries, or does each and every country have to have its own waste site?
So at the moment, and this is unlikely to change, all countries have to dispose of their own waste. When we're talking about the higher activity waste that comes particularly from nuclear energy, some countries are sharing in other types of waste disposal. For example, the kind of cesium medical isotopes that are used in hospital facilities. These are quite small sources, and some countries in Europe are starting to think about whether maybe they could share a borehole disposal facility for those kinds of wastes. But generally speaking, once you've created your own waste in your own country, you're responsible for it and you have to dispose of it.
So what does a country like Japan do, which is, as I understand it, pretty much a volcanic island that's tectonically active and could have an earthquake anywhere?
You're absolutely right. So Japan is a really interesting case. They are planning to build a geological disposal facility for their radioactive waste. As we all know, Japan have a very long history of nuclear power, and even past the 2011 Fukushima accident, they've started up their nuclear power stations again. So they are looking at a variety of different areas in different types of host rock to try and identify somewhere that has a very low risk of tectonic disruption. So again, this comes back to the point that I said earlier, really any rock is suitable to be a geological disposal facility. It just needs to have a low risk of that radioactive waste being exposed to future populations. And if the organisations involved in disposing the waste can make their case to the safety regulators that that's the case, then they should be able to get a permit to build their facility.
You just said that we want to minimise the risk of this waste coming to contact with human populations in the future. So it seems like the first thing is for something we don't really want to have happen, cause the radioactive isotopes to break free from the glass that we've put them into. So what exactly is the risk at that level? What do these radioactive isotopes do to their chemical and physical confinement inside this glass over long timescales?
Yeah, so I'm going to take the example of alpha particles. So if we can all think back to alpha, beta, gamma radiation. So let's talk about alpha particles. If we think about an alpha particle, which is a helium nucleus, it's quite big and it's quite heavy and it moves with quite a lot of energy inside a material. So if we take, for example, a crystalline material, so we'll come back to glass in a moment. If we have a crystalline material where there are atoms arranged in a periodic structure, it has very nicely arranged long-range order. As soon as the alpha particle hits an atom in that crystal lattice, it will displace it. And it will displace that atom, and there'll be a number of other displacements. So you can think of it a bit like a set of billiard balls. You have the cue ball hitting the triangle of balls, and they just scatter everywhere. So that's what happens when an alpha particle hits the crystal lattice inside a crystalline material. And obviously, the more bonds that you break, the more lattice positions that you move, the properties of that crystalline material break down over time, and they start to cause a lot of damage, which may impact the durability. So if you break that crystalline structure down, it might be easier to dissolve it in the groundwater, for example. So those radioactive decay processes inside the waste itself can be quite problematic. They can reduce the longevity, the durability of those materials. Now, this is one reason why we use glass. So glass doesn't have that crystalline, nice long-range order structure. It's a bit like a frozen liquid where there's no real long-range order. It's got short-range order, but not long-range. So when an alpha particle smashes through that structure, it doesn't really matter because it's got no structure in the first place. So glasses are remarkably resistant to radiation damage. That's not to say that not all crystalline materials behave in the same way. Some crystalline materials are very resistant to radiation, and they actually have internal defect and self-annealing repair mechanisms that can recover that damage. And therefore, there are some crystalline materials that make excellent candidates for radioactive waste, but there are also some crystalline materials that would be terrible.
So do we actually use some crystalline materials, in fact, in addition to the glass?
At the moment, no. But that brings us to something that I'm working a lot on in my research at the moment, is trying to explore the use of certain titanate minerals. So we're interested in a couple of key players who are pyrochlore and also zirconolite. These mineral structures are relatively radiation resistant. They do over time become completely radiation damaged. They become amorphous over time. This is a term we call metamictization. But despite this metamictization, which does happen over a very long period of time compared to other types of crystalline structures, they still retain the original uranium and thorium content that they started life with. And some of these minerals that I've been studying from the Canadian Shield, they're around about a billion years old, and they still contain uranium and thorium that has been locked up in their structures for that amount of time. So we understand that even though these minerals have been subject to hydrothermal alteration, even though they're completely metamict, they could be good host candidates for actinide wastes that come from nuclear power. And the one that we're interested in at the moment is whether we could use these minerals as a template to create waste forms for plutonium. They could also be used potentially for actinides that come from future fuel cycles. So new types of nuclear reactor that haven't yet been invented, they're on paper at the moment, but they all generate types of waste that you could potentially use these crystalline materials for disposing of the waste products.
But why would we ever want to do that? Do these minerals hold out the prospect that they're actually better than glass in terms of how they respond to radiation damage over tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of years?
So these crystalline materials, whilst they're not as good as glass at being resistant to radiation damage, they ultimately will become amorphous. The key factor here is that they are orders of magnitude more durable. So when you try and dissolve these materials, they are completely different. So glass is a very durable material, super durable. And you'll know this if you put glassware into your dishwasher, which is an extraordinarily harsh environment. If you think of all of the detergent and the soap and the temperature and whatever, you will see sometimes on the outside of your glass this cloudy white layer. That's a corrosion layer on the glass. But, you know, no matter how many times you put your glasses in the dishwasher, they don't completely dissolve, right? It's a very durable material, and that's just the same for radioactive waste glass. If we put a fistful size of radioactive waste glass into a bucket of water, it would still be there after several hundreds of thousands of years. These are very durable materials, and we can look into the geological record to see also glasses that are tens of millions of years old. There are obsidian glasses that are very old. But if we then go away and look at the titanate minerals, the zirconolites, the pyroclores, they are several of orders of magnitude more durable than glass. So they really win on the durability perspective. And the durability is important because when the groundwater comes into contact with these waste minerals, the process of dissolving out the radionuclides, it has to be as slow as possible for us to have confidence that those radionuclides aren't going to escape to the geosphere and they're not going to escape to the biosphere. And so crystalline materials, for me, they win hands down on durability.
I see. So you're saying even if each of these materials could be damaged, either the glass or the titanite and zirconolite, even the presence of water or hydrothermal fluids, we've seen that the minerals will not release the radioactive isotopes?
Yes, exactly. So some of the minerals that I've been studying where you see these small hydrothermal veins, we think the temperature of those hydrothermal events was somewhere on the order of 300 degrees Celsius, which is much hotter than we expect any groundwater in the geological disposal facility to be. We do see slight leaching of the uranium, but it only ever is transported a very small distance. So we can have really strong confidence that these are really very durable materials.
Are the uranium or the radioactive isotopes located as part of the crystal structure in these minerals, or are they in interstitial sites?
They're absolutely inside the main lattice structure. So if we take zirconolite, its prototypical formula is a calcium zirconium titanate, so CaZrTi2O7. And so the uranium will sit either on the calcium site or on the zirconium site or both. So it's very flexible. Same with the thorium. And that's how we're using that crystal structure as a template for synthetic materials, where we can look at those and go, well, all right, we can maybe put some plutonium on the calcium site and we can put some on the zirconium site, but we might need to add some charge balance on the titanium site. So why don't we try and use some iron? So we just tinker with the chemical structure to try and recreate what nature has given us to find the most radiation stable, the most durable, the most long-lived crystal composition that we can possibly find.
So you mentioned that permeability is the number one criterion that we look for in these deep geological storage sites. But over the timescale we're talking about, can rocks change in their permeability, or can the water level change so that these materials would eventually be exposed to circulating fluids?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think when the organisations who are looking at these particular sites to find out whether they're suitable, future change in, for example, sea level rise or other various climate changes is something they have to take into consideration. Will these changes affect how water is entering the site, how it's leaving the site? This is something that they'll have to ascertain. It's something that's very difficult to do. Most climate prediction models at the moment only go out to the end of this century and a little bit beyond. But what we're talking about now are much longer timescales to be able to say, well, this is where we think the sea level will be and so on. So that is definitely something that will have to be looked at and taken into consideration when a site is being selected in the future.
Where are the existing deep geological storage sites? Are there quite a few that are already in service?
Well, despite this being something that has been rumbling on for many decades now, there are no operating facilities for high-level radioactive waste in the world, but that doesn't mean to say that they're not being built. In Finland, the Onkalo facility is being constructed right now. This is a facility that's being built in a very old gneiss, this very stable crystalline old rock, and the construction is ongoing. I've been down. I had the lucky opportunity to drive all the way down. It's 475 metres below ground. As you drive through the tunnels, there are two big fractures. Water is pouring through those fractures, but the fractures only go through the entrance tunnel. They don't go anywhere near any of the storage vaults. And they're literally building tunnel after tunnel after tunnel at the moment, ready for when they're going to put the first spent nuclear fuel. This is fuel that's come straight from the reactor, not recycled. This will go into the facility at some point, we're hoping in the next decade or so. So that's really exciting that the Finnish facility will be the first. Other countries are also planning facilities, and they're at various different stages, either in construction or planning. So Sweden is building their facility in the same rock as the Finnish one. In Switzerland and France, they're using clay, so a completely different type of concept where you have super impermeable rock. It requires different construction techniques because the rock's perhaps not quite as strong. And other countries around the world are trying to find a site, or they're not thinking about it yet. The only other one I will raise is a facility in the US in New Mexico called WIP. It's the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant. And this is a facility that is underground. It's built in an evaporite deposit. And they have been disposing there some military waste from the US military program. And that's been operational for a number of years. And some of you may have heard that there was an accident there a few years ago and there was a small release of radioactivity. It's really a good lesson to see how humans aren't infallible in this situation. The rocks are doing their job just fine. There's a hole dug, they're drilling vaults, and they're doing everything that they want, but there have been some human error that led to a mistake there. So that's something to think about. We can put our trust in the rocks, but we can't necessarily put a trust in ourselves.
I presume that nobody really wants this kind of thing in their backyard, so how do we actually go about selecting a site?
Different countries have done different things. I can talk about my experience from the UK perspective. We have a voluntary site selection process, which is actually also how it was done in Finland and Sweden, in Canada. And so what these countries do is to find a community who volunteer to have it. So in the UK process, we need two important things. One is a good host rock, a suitable host rock, and a willing community. If we don't have those two things, we can't move forward with any particular site. You might be thinking, well, why? Why would a community want to have a radioactive waste disposal facility near them? And one of the major incentives is the financial boost that will come with that. So governments offer the communities money, essentially, to support their local community. And in Finland and Sweden, actually, it came down to two communities and they were fighting over it because they really wanted that investment. And the area, particularly in Finland, where they have this facility, they get so much money and taxes from the radioactive waste disposal facility, plus other industry in the area, that they've got some of the best hospitals, the best schools in the country. So there really are incentives for local communities to have this disruption. And I think that's one of the biggest problems that local people find with this facility. It's not so much about the long-term safety, because there's a general trust that if we as scientists say it's going to be safe, then okay, all right, generally it will be safe. What's more of concern is the day-to-day disruption, digging all of that rock out from under the ground and having all the trucks going by and all this kind of stuff. That's more, I think, what people are concerned about.
So we're really talking about centralized facilities that will provide enough space for the entire radioactive waste of a given country with all that disruption. So roughly what kind of volumes of waste are we talking about?
I can talk about the UK perspective because that's what I really know. The UK has a volume of 750,000 cubic metres of waste, and that's a difficult volume to think of. So we tend to think of it in terms of the volume of Wembley Stadium, so the home of English football. Okay, if you were to fill Wembley Stadium about two-thirds full, that's about the volume of waste that we have. Now, the area underground, it's difficult to think of what that translates into in terms of a cubic meter volume of rock that has to be excavated. The way that the Waste Management Organisation thinks about it is actually in square footage underground. We're thinking about an area underground of around 26 square kilometres. So it's really like the size of a large town underground is what we're going to be building.
Wow, that's enormous.
It is quite huge. It's important to say that the surface footprint will be a lot smaller. So the surface footprint will have probably the waste being delivered on a train or by boat, potentially, depending on where it's located. The waste will be offloaded and then sent on probably something like a railway down into the facility. So that you can think of a bit more like a kind of football pitch size. But underground, the extent is absolutely vast. That's a huge amount of rock that's going to be excavated to host all of that waste.
We're talking about periods of time here that are so much longer than any human organization or human structure has existed. Do we even know how to think about planning for millennia into the future?
It is a really good question, and it's very difficult to foresee those really long time scales. What I would do is flip it on its head and say, well, how good are we going to be at actually managing this waste above ground for the next 50 years, 100 years, these timescales we can look to. And that's where we are at the moment. We have the waste in these above ground facilities. Can we guarantee that they're going to be safe over the course of 100 years? Probably. I mean, probably our society is going to be more or less how it is now in 100 years' time. Better, I hope, thinking with my optimist hat on. But over 500 years, can we guarantee that the people are going to be 500 years hence from now? Will they be able to look after the waste in the same way? Will they have the same technology? Will we have the same kind of stability? So I think the question is, isn't it better to try and isolate it away from future populations over timescales that we can't imagine than leave it where it is for now on timescales that we can? So while it is very difficult to think about those long timescales, I think the alternative is worse. One other thing to say is that on a geological timescale, what we're talking about here isn't very long. You and I, we think of a million years as a blink of an eye in terms of a geological timescale. But for these materials, for engineers, for people who think about corrosion of the container materials, what's going to sit around the container, the waste itself, a million years is a tremendously long amount of time. We can only do as best as we can as scientists in the lab to be able to try and predict how those materials are going to behave over a long time period. I would love to have a time machine and to be able to fast forward a million years to say, yes, do you know what? That geological disposal facility worked. It did what it needed to do. But we don't, so we have to try and do what we can.
But do we worry about potential bad actors having access to this, or are there much easier ways to wreak nuclear havoc than digging up some ancient radioactive waste facility?
Well, I think the idea is that once the waste is disposed, and countries are thinking about this now, that when it's disposed underground and it's all sealed off and closed, that potential future bad actors won't know it's there. The idea is that we bury it and we completely forget. And this is, for example, what Finland have decided to do, that there is nothing that points to future populations to say, hey guys, there's this stuff here that you might want to get out of the ground. It's better that it's completely forgotten. And that's not the opinion of everybody. Some people think that it should be marked, and there are some wonderful plans for putting up really scary statues to make it look like a very uninviting place, because we might not be able to rely upon language being the same over the million year timescale. There are other slightly more crazy ideas about trying to, this is genuine, I don't know how it would ever work, but genetically engineer cats so that when they came into a particular perimeter near the geological disposal facility, their fur would change colour. I mean, you can think of all of the weird and the wonderful things that you want to. People are thinking about this. How do we mark that facility in the future? But to make sure that it's completely forgotten is probably the goal, so that waste can safely radioactively decay, completely undisturbed, for the million years that's required.
What are you working on at the moment?
So aside from the question about plutonium, there's other sets of projects I like to call turning radioactive waste into rocks. So this is the idea around using the titanate minerals as a template for future waste types. We also do a lot of work trying to develop new types of glass materials for types of waste that don't currently have a disposal route. They need to be transformed in some way into a safer material, and actually glass is a brilliant material, as we've discussed. And so we're using what we know about the earth, the deep earth, and how rocks are melted. We take all that knowledge and try and translate it into developing new types of glass materials, essentially. And when those glass materials are developed, we're also very much interested in how quickly they dissolve. So we do a lot of experiments to try and understand the rate at which the radionuclides that we're trying to lock up inside their structure, how quickly they might be released as well.
Claire Corkill, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
To see pictures and illustrations that support this podcast, go to geologybytes.com. where you'll also find transcripts and a subject matter index of all the episodes. There you can also give me feedback, which I welcome, as well as sign up to get my emails about new episodes.